Welcome back to the AgTech So What podcast, brought to you by AgThentic. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Today's episode is a slightly edited recording of the first national virtual AgTech meetup. The topic, alternative proteins. Three guests, a chef and cellular agriculture entrepreneur, a chemistry PhD and disruption researcher, and an internationally recognized veterinary immunologist and inventor, each share 5 minutes of their thoughts on the alternative protein space, and then we have a discussion, or I guess maybe more of a debate. We cover what these products are, what's driving their cost, when they'll hit the market, and how much market share they'll actually get, and what all of this means for farmers, investors, and all of us as consumers. There's a lot to cover, and during the event, we had slides and shared some resources. All of this is available on our website at agtechsowhat.com. Please check it out. Like at an in-person meetup, we share a bit of community news and then jump into the event.
So we have just launched the Australian AgriTech Association, which is an initiative across Australia and meant to be across all sectors for the benefit of AgriTech, really looking at placing Australia in the center of this opportunity, helping with both local community building and collaboration, as well as attracting external investment and positioning Australia as a leader in terms of the knowledge and innovation that we can produce. So hop on to the website there and you can check it out. So what can you expect from tonight? This will be the last bit for me. I mean, alternative protein is something we've been hearing about, that it will be the biggest disruption, that big food companies, ag companies, tech companies are investing millions and billions of dollars, and that agriculture will fundamentally change. But there's also plenty of skeptics about that future and evidence that says the technology is too expensive, the business case doesn't stack up, or it's not nutritious enough, or it's just a small niche percentage of consumers. And then there's folks, I suppose, like us and probably many of you that are somewhere in the middle, that believe there's a protein gap that's really big and that we'll need many types of protein to fill it. And that doing so, especially here in Australia, is a massive opportunity. And we were excited to bring all three of those perspectives to you tonight with our experts on this panel. So in terms of what they'll talk about, will alternative protein go mainstream? What the rise of alternative protein means for producers, including meat producers? And what are the opportunities? And what are the risks if we get this wrong? Our experts have really different backgrounds and really different approaches to this space. So you can expect frank conversations. We had a great prep chat and managed to keep them from not fighting, but we'll see how we go tonight. Not everyone will agree, though. We will try to keep it evidence-based and not too technical. And ultimately, we really hope that you learn something new and that maybe it challenges your views on this space or inspires you to take an action that will benefit yourself or your business. So with that, I will turn it over to our first panelist to give a bit of an introduction on yourself. So Catherine from Rethink, calling in from the UK, I believe.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, so I'm Catherine Tubb and I work for RethinkX, which is a startup, an independent think tank looking at technology-driven disruptions. My background is in finance for 10 years and a PhD from Cambridge University before then. So at RethinkX, as I said, we study historical disruptions and forecast coming disruptions. So what is a disruption? It's when a new product, business or service helps create a new market and significantly diminishes, transforms or destroys an existing product, market or category. And disruption is not destruction, right? The disruption of the horse with the car created whole new bigger industries and new jobs. So it's important we do not underestimate disruptions. The cost of missing out can be huge. So for example, in 1985, AT&T asked McKinsey to project cell phone penetration in the US in the year 2000. They estimated 900,000 subscribers, but the actual number was closer to 109 million. They were off by 120 times and as a result missed out on tremendous wealth creation, which of course other companies seized. So at RethinkX, we look at technology disruption through a framework, laying out our blueprint for analysing and anticipating disruption. So one pillar of this is we know that technology cost curves fall fast and at exponential rates. So for example, in biotechnologies like genome sequencing, cost improvements are leaving improvements in informational technologies, represented by Moore's law on this graph, for dust. And we've seen this in action just recently, where it's taken just weeks to sequence the various strains of COVID-19. The next pillar is technological convergence, which acts as the common catalyst to make disruptions possible by enabling products, businesses and services with certain functionalities at a certain cost just not available before. And there are loads of examples of these, the car, the household refrigerator and the smartphone, just to name a few. And all these products have continued to improve in capability, with the most modern versions of these looking sometimes very different to those first examples. And this continued involvement in capability of these disruptive technologies is important, as the point of disruption does not mark the end of improvement. The next pillar is that we see a lot of linear projections, but no technology in history has ever been adopted linearly. Technology gets adopted as S-curves. And adoption happens seemingly slowly, then reaches a critical mass, which is usually around 10 to 20%, or tipping point, and they explode before slowing down again. Again, something that a lot of people are familiar with now after COVID-19. And in the meantime, the cost of the technology continues to go down exponentially. The mainstream analysis failed to see S-curve disruption. This is the IEA projection of solar PV starting in 2006, and the black line is reality and the other coloured lines are the forecast, which are linear despite solar now being one of the cheapest forms of energy. The final pillar of disruption, our disruption framework, is business model innovation. The whole on-demand or app culture that we know today, from Uber to Airbnb to Netflix, has just come about in the last 10 years and has come about from technological convergence. We don't think food's going to be any different. We anticipate a complete business model transformation of the food system with a completely new value chain, which we call food as software. How we design, develop, produce and distribute food will change. And the companies leading this are not necessarily the incumbent players, but the biotech and information tech companies behind the scenes. In our food report, we focus on the convergence of precision biology and fermentation into a technology we call precision fermentation. It will allow us to harness microbes as mini biological factories to produce any protein at high speed and volume. We can program microbes to produce any specific protein or molecule we desire. And protein is not just food. It's in the enzymes in washing powder or in cosmetics and shampoo or the core building blocks of leather. Precision fermentation can be used for any molecule as well. There are startup companies making products from palm oil, coffee, sugar substitutes, bricks and indigo dye, all in fermentation units. Precision fermentation has been disrupting protein production for 40 years, starting with human insulin, Humulin, made via yeast in 1978. Disruption was rapid and followed an S-curve, reaching more than 95% adoption in just 13 years. And the technology has improved further, with Humulin itself being disrupted by other human analog insulins. So how is this going to disrupt the cow? Well, it starts with gaining critical market share to build the industry, bring the cost curve down and reach that tipping point. And these products are being made now. And these are products that we cannot extract from nature, like human proteins, milk, collagen and insulin, or proteins that are simply too expensive to extract, often from plants, indigo, vanilla, brazzein, and proteins from extinct plants and animals. At RethinkX, we do forecast cost curves, and precision fermentation is no different to other technologies. We anticipate the cost to produce 1 kilo of protein will be $10 per kilo by 2025. And a really interesting thing starts to happen when we reach this cost point. This is when we're cost competitive with bulk proteins sourced from animals. What kind of animal proteins? Well, dairy proteins like casein and whey. The ability to make these specific identical proteins is a game changer in where precision fermentation and plant-based products differ. In precision fermentation, you are making the exact same protein in abundance. Disruption will be driven by the B2B market. Think Nestle, who buy 1.6% of global milk supply, not to go into milk, but products like lasagna and chocolate. And precision fermentation is going to allow Nestle to buy these dairy proteins cheaper, also a less volatile supply and locally produced just to put into these products. And in the US, this B2B market is huge. 35% of the total dairy market ends up in use as an ingredient. And replacing these with the exact same proteins means production will be rapid, as we've seen in the past. For ingredients, think cheese on a store-bought pizza or lasagna or used in food service or restaurants. For example, 50% of US butter and cheese is used in these industries and has been decimated by the global coronavirus crisis. And a quick question, I'll come back to at the end, is how much of US cheese market do you think ends up on a pizza? And this leads us to the idea of market trauma, which is when technologies can disrupt the economics of an incumbent industry way before they have any kind of market share, be it 10, 20 or 30%. Small changes lead to rapid feedback loops favouring the new technology and seeing trauma to the old. And US dairy is seeing this twofold. Two high-profile dairy processor closures a few months ago from just a few percentage points change in demand, as well as the impact from COVID-19. Now imagine what a tenfold decrease in prices could do. And this is what precision fermentation is, a tenfold improvement in efficiency from everything including energy, water, time. And this is an order of magnitude and will translate to cost. The cow will simply be unable to compete. These feedback loops are why we forecast precision fermentation and its enabled industries will grow rapidly and by 2030 have 70% of the US market with just 30% of protein coming from cows. Translating this into the number of cows means we expect 50% fewer in the US by 2030. By 2035, we expect industrial cattle farming to be more or less obsolete in the US. It won't end with cows, no animal will be safe, and eventually our whole food system will change. This is going to have huge implications for everything we know, from the environment to investment to economics, society, food security, which is why we want to come now to start this discussion so that we can get ahead of it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Catherine. That was a whirlwind. I love it. So we will save the questions until the panel. And next up, we have George from VOW.
Awesome. Thank you, Sarah. Hey, everyone. My name's George. I'm one of the founders and the CEO of VOW. We are Australia's cultured meat company. Before I get into what cultured meat is, where it is, and who VOW is, I wanted to quickly touch on what cultured meat isn't. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of products like the Impossible Burger, Beyond Burger, or V2 Burger. These are products on the market today. You can walk into a Woolies or a Hungry Jack's and go and pick one up right now. These products are made from plants. They take in agricultural commodities like soy and process them to mimic the flavor and experience of meat, but they're not meat. They're replicating the experience using very different ingredients. Cultured meat, on the other hand, is a very different approach that's not yet on the market. So the meat that we eat today, we breed and we raise animals. We breed and we raise animals to maturity, slaughter them, take the flesh of that animal, and then discard the remainder of the carcass. That flesh is made up mostly of skeletal muscle cells, alongside some fat cells and connective tissue cells and a few others. Cultured meat is exactly the same thing. It's skeletal muscle cells, fat cells, and connective tissue cells, but grown outside of the animal. The way we do that is we take an almond-sized biopsy from an animal, from the muscle of that animal, and from that biopsy, we extract the cells that are responsible for repairing muscle, fat, and connective tissue. We can store those cells indefinitely, and at any point, go to our freezer, take these cells out, and place them in an environment that convinces them they're still inside the animal. In this environment, those cells will divide and divide and divide and divide, and when we have enough, we can change that, and those cells will then turn into muscle fibers, fat, and connective tissue that forms real meat. So cultured meat is a way of making exactly the same thing we eat today. It's biologically identical, but made without the rest of the animal. Back in 2013, this was the first time that cultured meat really emerged as a topic when Mark Post in the Netherlands created this $300,000 burger. And that single burger patty is just mind-bogglingly expensive. In the intervening 7 years, a lot has changed about the cultured meat industry. We went from one research group in the world working on it to over 40 companies on almost every continent working on bringing cultured meat to market. The cost has dropped precipitously for precisely the reasons Catherine touched on. The reductions in cost of recombinant proteins and the wider availability of processing infrastructure has meant that cost has come down from about $300,000 for a single burger patty all the way down to just a couple of $100 a kilo, depending on the company that you ask. Another driver of this is there was no real investment in this sector 7 years ago. And so far in 2020, since the 1st of January, there's been over $160 million invested in these cultured meat companies by private investors alone, and likely more by governments around the world. One of the really compelling characteristics of cultured meat is any animal flesh can be produced using this method. So up here on the left, you can see Memphis Meats from California, their chicken breast product. In the middle, you can see Aleph Farm from Israel's three-dimensional beefsteak. And on the right, you can see Shiok Meats prawn dumplings made in Singapore. This technology is capable of producing anything that we're currently raising or catching animals in order to create. But there's a bigger opportunity than just a production technology here. And at VOW, our focus is not on producing the things that we're familiar with. Rather, it's on crafting a new category of food using this technology. If we're going to go to the effort to learn how to do tissue culture to create food, why should we limit ourselves to the things that we've conventionally eaten? So our approach is to build a library of cells that come from both domesticated and undomesticated species. this library ultimately becomes a repertoire of new ingredients that we can be drawing on to create an essentially limitless range of new types of food. This includes both exotic species, which could never be industrialized. Think things like Galapagos tortoise, which Charles Darwin said was his all-time favorite meat, as well as blends of cells from different species to create food characteristics that are better than any single species would be able to create. Imagine mixing the skeletal muscle of kangaroo with the fat cells of salmon with the liver cells of beef to create something which is high in protein, high in omega-3, and micronutrient dense. That's the long-term vision for Val, but we are a very young company. We were founded almost exactly 1 year ago. In fact, it was our birthday last Friday. And in this time, we have proved one of the big underlying hypotheses that growing cells from different species, both domesticated and undomesticated, is similarly easy. We're now a team of nine. We've got seven different species that we're working with, and we're currently focused entirely on R&D to bring these products to market to give all of you entirely new types of food experiences, which would never be possible with animal agriculture.
Our last panelist is Paul Wood, who brings a very different view of alternative proteins than George and Catherine.
Thanks, Sarah. So firstly, before I start, I just want to call out to any farmers who might be on the line. While we're all shut down with COVID and at home, there's a whole lot of farmers out there in paddocks, milking sheds, who are actually feeding us. So thank you to all those people out there. We don't have a society unless we have food, and that's why this is such an important topic. So a call out to them, and just to remind people who don't know, you know, in Australia, we produce enough food to feed 60 million people. So there's no need to panic. We have plenty of food in this country. So it's not one of those issues that when you talk about sovereign capability that we have any issue with. We're a major exporter of food. So I'm an immunologist by training, spent about 13 years in CSIRO, managed to invent something that went around the world as a global diagnostic for TB, moved across into CSL, ran their animal health, the R&D, and then when they were acquired by Pfizer, moved into the US to run global R&D for Pfizer, which was the biggest animal health company in the world. Now back in Australia, sitting on boards like the Dairy Australia board. So let's move from the theoretical to the real and talk about where alternative proteins fit in. So I definitely believe there is a space for alternative proteins in food, in the food systems, but I'm a believer that they're really a niche product. They're not going to overtake mainstream livestock produced products. And in reality, a lot of them, if you know, let's think about the plant-based products. We used to call them vegetables, and now we call them alternative proteins. So that's fine. So there's a bit of competition out there. And that's what you've got to match up to. So that's really the debate. It's not whether they should exist or anything. It's that they do exist. There's a place for them. But is it mainstream like Catherine believes, or is it niche? So let's have a look at some of those issues. And I think the biggest problem is really that they aren't the solution for the growing world population that you hear some people start. I think everyone knows we're going to grow to 9 or 10 billion people. We actually know where those people are going to be. They're going to be in Africa. They're going to be in parts of Asia. And if you look at Africa alone, we've got over a billion smallholder farmers. So the definition of that is they earn less than $2 US a day. So they're out there feeding their families and growing a bit of protein, whether it's plants or animals. And alternative proteins, as you've heard described, are not going to solve their problems. Price alone is an issue, let alone a lot of other issues we can get in. So we're talking about a set of products that are really for people who can afford choice. So I get a little annoyed when I hear people start with, we're feeling the new population. You're not. So, and we've also got in Africa, we've got 150 million children who have micronutrient deficiency, and one egg a day or a glass of milk would solve that problem entirely. So what we're going to see in those countries, and it's the data, is actually that the sales of meat-based products or animal-based products are increasing exponentially because they need to eat more animal-based protein for their nutrition. We're seeing a market that is quickly saturating for alternative proteins. Interesting alone, the Grains and Legumes Council in Australia did a survey last year, 137 plant-based meat substitutes on the supermarket shelves today, 137. Bit of competition out there today, even before you get started with anything else. Most of them, on average, had about six times the amount of sodium. So we can get into the debate about nutrition, but there's some nutritional issues there against natural products as well. We get into the growth in the market. You know, vegans, vegetarians, around 4 to 12%, depending on whose figures you believe, been pretty static for a while. So, you know, if that's the big market, and then people will switch and say, oh, yeah, but there's flexitarians. And by the nature of flexitarian, they flex in and they flex out. So you wouldn't want to put your whole dollar on them, continue to buy your product. We produce a lot of high quality, nutritious, delicious animal-based proteins, and people will continue to eat those. So they're not going away. We also understand sustainability, and everyone's been working at this. So we've had some significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from both the plant-based and livestock-based industries, and that's continuing with some pretty aggressive targets that we can talk about. Another interesting figure, if you look at livestock, 86% of what livestock eat isn't digestible by humans. So they're actually very good at converting pasture that's not arable land and into a product that you can eat. So they're very efficient. That's why they're very popular in places like Africa. So I suppose overall what we do need is a balanced discussion towards this whole issue about food security. We can get into the issue about Catherine's view about where precision fermentation. I've spent my career in industry. I know a bit about fermentation. I would distinguish particularly between bacterial and yeast versus cell-based. There's a dramatic difference in cost of production for those things. So we need to think about that. And to be honest, the industry you don't want to be in is the commodity. You know, after all, what we're talking about is competing with a burger, competing with minced meat. This is at the bottom of the red meat area alone. So, you know, $6 a kilo, you know, out of the US, in the shops here, I just looked up today, about $10 a kilo. It's a tough space to be in. Generally, when you go out with new technologies, you want to be in high value spaces where you're going to get return on your investment. We've seen some interesting investments in Possible, Beyond a Great, but let's take a bit of the hype. Beyond went up to being a $14 billion business. It's now down to about $4 billion. So $10 billion has been taken off the table already. So, you know, there's a little bit of hype in there. Impossible just did a great raise, $500 million raise. But all of those raises are pretty insignificant compared to the actual investment in the food industry. So off a low base, and we'll get into the report, really good report out of AFI recently, saying much the same as I'm saying, and that is if you look at where food and protein supply in Australia is going, these products are really going to be in that sort of 10% of the market share. So as I said, I actually believe in alternative proteins. I just have a different view of what they're going to do to transform the food security systems around the world. So Sarah, I might leave it at that.
Awesome, Paul. Thank you. So with that, we might jump into a bit of a panel discussion.
With those initial thoughts from the panelists, we get into a discussion that gets quite heated. Given this is a super complicated space with lots of technical terms, I start by asking George to give us an overview of the different types of alternative protein.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you've gone into a supermarket or you've got into a burger joint and you've had a veggie burger, odds are that's going to be something like a soy protein. And these products have been around for decades. We've had these textured soy proteins on the market for a really, really long time. They have been, up until recently, pretty much the most repulsive category of food I can imagine. Only in the last 5 or 6 years did some newer tech companies come in and say, well, there's an opportunity to make some really extraordinary products here. So we've had companies like Impossible and Beyond, which spent literally years deconstructing what makes meat, meat, and rebuilding that from the ground up from a molecular level. The Impossible Burger took that to another extreme. They took textured soy protein, processed from soybeans and basically extruded as a protein concentrate, so it's much, much higher protein than the plants that go in. And then they've used a bacterial system to express hemoglobin or lehemoglobin from soybean root nodules that they add into that burger. So you essentially create a burger which has real hemoglobin, the same thing that makes meat red, that makes it cook to that brown color and makes it bleed. So you end up with this product, which is a plant-based burger that is so compelling and realistic in its appearance and its flavor and its texture. And this is really the first generation of products we're experiencing now that have been deconstructed from meat and rebuilt from the constituent molecules. That category is on the market and widely available. Then there's cultured meat, and that's what we work on at Vow. This is a new category. No one is commercial anywhere in the world with this product yet. But there is a lot of work going into it because it is real meat. It gets around a lot of the arguments that if you want to eat meat, just eat meat, and moves into this new territory where all of the downsides of meat, all of the problems that people have, which are legitimate problems around the ethics of animal agriculture and the environmental footprint, especially of factory farming outside of Australia, you can avoid those and still get to enjoy the meat products that are so desirable. There's also some other categories. I'm just going to mention one very, very quickly, which involve this almost like alchemist approach. There's crazy companies in Finland which are using solar power, water, and CO2 to create literally bulk protein from thin air. So we're right at the start of these new generation protein products. Think of where we are now as like the first iPhone. No one really wants it, but in 10 years, we're all going to have one.
So we have a new generation of plant-based proteins, like the Impossible Burger. And then there's cultured meat, or cellular agriculture, as some call it, which is what George's company, Vow, is doing. There's one more term that you'll hear a bunch on this episode, and then I want to quickly explain. That is recombinant protein. Basically, it's a genetic manufacturing process where you can create large volumes of protein by taking DNA from an organism and placing it into a genetically modified bacteria or other cell type. So recombinant protein isn't just for food. It can be used for medical or industrial applications. Insulin, for example, is made this way. In food, the key thing to remember is that recombinant protein makes parts of whole foods rather than whole products, like with cultured meat. The hemoglobin, or heme, in the Impossible Burger that George mentioned, for example, is a recombinant protein. Other companies like Perfect Day use a recombinant protein as the whey in their ice cream. Though these products are in market now, I've actually eaten an Impossible Burger, no one in the cultured meat world has been able to get the cost down enough to actually produce a cellular agriculture product for us as consumers at a reasonable price. Catherine believes the costs will fall, though, and will fall rapidly. But Paul shares a different view.
Yeah, so look, I read Catherine's report, the RethinkX report, and I was intrigued by why they thought it might be reduced. I sourced the information on fermentation costs to a report by the Good Food Institute, and I went and had a look at that report in 2019. First thing I was struck by is they made a couple of assumptions in putting price together, which I think are totally wrong. So the first assumption they made was that the media you use for cell culture is about 20% the cost of manufacture. Well, it's actually about 20, you know, sorry, they said it was 80. It's actually about 20. So it's a pretty big assumption there that is just blown away. They also didn't include capital cost in there, you know, a 20,000 litre water jacketed, steam sterilizable unit is about 250,000 US. And then you've got to put it into a room that has to have positive pressure because you want to keep microbes out of it. You're trying to run a 40-day sterile culture. You've got energy costs. Oxford University's done a report that says unless the energy costs for cultured meat was entirely non-carbon based, then you wouldn't even be balancing out on a carbon footprint basis. So the business model piece just doesn't work for me when I look at what would have to go into the capital cost of building a factory.
George, maybe not surprisingly, disagrees on how production costs will drop and when.
Paul, you're entirely right. These were expensive products 20 years ago, but Impossible used about 1% of their final ingredient weight is a purified recombinant hemoglobin, and that just dropped from, what was it, $6 a pound to $4.50 a pound in the US? We're talking about a product which contains a meaningful amount of a purified recombinant protein, which is very close to being price competitive with beef. Today, as a 7-year-old company, project forward 10 years with even a small advance in technology, and that is going to be very competitive with commodity beef in the US. There's also companies like Perfect Day and Geltor, which are also doing food-grade dairy proteins. You can go and buy their ice cream in the US today. Geltor is doing food-grade collagen. They're already in the cosmetics industry, and they're just moving into collagen in food production. These all exist today. These are companies which didn't even exist 7 years ago. This has come from nothing to a bunch of commercial products in a very, very short time.
Given these are foods we're talking about here, taste is a big factor. Catherine explains what her research found about both taste and price.
So when we look at disruption, we always think, as I mentioned, this point about how capabilities continue to improve. So we do see things like the Impossible Burger, which has 2% of recombinant protein in. You know, that's version, in fact, they call their latest release version 2. Now imagine when we get to, you know, just as we have with iPhones, version 10, 11, 12. And we do think this will continue to get better. It just becomes a recipe. And this is what we call food as software, this idea of developing and making food better, which we see anyway in food all the time, right? So we don't think that today's product offering is what we're going to be eating in 10 years' time. And that's really important to remember, because the cow ultimately cannot improve that much, right? Whereas, as George mentioned in his talk, you could mix proteins and fats from a variety of different produce, or even, you know, the Galapagos turtle, we could all be having that on our lunch plate. So the kind of options and possibilities of food is actually going to expand hugely. I do want to just address some of Paul's comments about costing. So I think the Oxford University report on energy, for a start, energy, we're also about to release a report on energy costs, and energy is also going to come down a lot because photovoltaics plus batteries, which is now cheaper pretty much than fossil fuels. And then also there are companies coming out. It's not just the product, it's the technology on how to produce. There's a company called Stam, which have produced a £1 million unit to make recombinant proteins that they license out, and it's the size of a person. I mean, that's going to be a game changer, right? We're not talking necessarily about traditional fermentation. The whole system is going to be changing, and the whole investment and capital costs are going to be coming down. In 1912, the car was perceived as a threat only to the top end of the buggy market. And this is a quote from the carriage trade. Though the shift understandably distressed the affected firms, observers took comfort that the high-grade horse-drawn vehicles accounted for a relatively small percentage of the trade. Losses here hardly imperiled the entire industry. And this was the buggy carriage trade, which approximately 10 years later didn't exist. So I think it's just important to remember that although you might take comfort that it's going to be this niche product now, actually, we say disruption happens in such a way that everything comes toppling down, and it won't be. I think it's just important to remember we've seen these patterns of disruption in the past, and we've seen these kind of industries completely taken by surprise. And this is really why we did our report, because we think the same is happening in food, and we want people to be prepared. We want farmers to be prepared, because we think there's going to be huge change. And the worst thing is if people are taken by surprise when all the signs were there that this was going to happen.
I think that point around farmers and industry response is a really relevant one, and we're excited to be doing this meetup live so that a number of farmers and industry folks can join. I would love to hear your thoughts, and Paul, we might start with you, on what are your recommendations to industry, whether you're a farmer or someone sitting in an industry body, in thinking about this space from your perspective, given how you see it playing out.
Well, the first thing I'd say is don't abandon farming, because this technology is going to come by 25. The probability of that is bugger all. You know, we haven't even scaled. So I think where the challenge, I'd say to Catherine, find a biological system to start talking about rather than cars, because biological systems are a little bit different than manufacturing with steel. They're variable by the nature that they're biological.
As you can probably tell, things were getting pretty intense, and they continued to escalate given how incredibly passionate all of these people are about their work and about this space.
Well, let's just take another issue. So let's think about what you're going to do with your precision fermentated milk. So you're going to make a handful of proteins in recombinant, and then we're going to blend them back together. We're going to have to put some other products in there. So we're going to have to put a bit of fat in there. We're going to have to put some calcium in there. And then we're going to hope that it actually might taste like something. What's a recombinant protein taste like? So one of the things that some people in this game have forgotten about is that taste and texture is the king in food. There's a company in New Zealand, I won't name them, making a product, a chicken product, where they didn't actually think taste was that important, but the vegans actually did a taste test, and it scored 2 out of 25 on a taste test. So the market does expect things. And again, I'm talking about the commodity market. Let's talk about, you know, when AOK, they sell one of their prime steaks at $200 a steak. Blackmore sells at $600 a kilo. I mean, that's the market I want to be in.
This part is a bit hard to hear, but George is jumping in to make a point about the kinds of consumers who can afford premium products.
When you talk about the African farmers on $2 a day in the introduction, is that $600 a kilo?
I'm talking about the market you're in. I'm talking about the consumer market you can afford to pay.
Alternative proteins are too expensive, but at the same time, you want to be in a $600 a kilo premium livestock market.
If I'm talking about Western market versus an African market, they're two different distinctions. What I was making is people make this assumption that these things are all things. They should go and actually look at the African market. It's a totally different market. We're not talking about Africa tonight because nothing we're talking about is relevant to them, other than, I suppose, Catherine's point that the cow can't improve. We're improving on genetics of animals at the moment at a rate about 3% compounding per annum. We produce more milk today with a fraction of the number of cows we produced previously. So we're continuing to improve in animals. Genetics is a very powerful tool for that. We've got lots of different breeds for different reasons. So there's a lot of reasons that we look at there about the continuing improvement we see in agriculture at the moment. And just some, so the nutrition thing and the food tasting, I'd happily take on the competition about putting up a natural product like cow's milk against a fermented recombinant protein gemish that then doesn't even have the absorption capability that we have with a natural product. So that's a bit of a no contest for me on that one.
They've already done that. The dairy farmers of the US tasted some of the Perfect Day ice cream and they actually said they were worried because it tasted so good. So, I mean, this is happening and this is version one. I mean, this is the other thing, as I keep mentioning, things are going to get better. They're going to improve. Everything you mention is solvable. You can keep getting better. You can make those recipes better. The cow might have improvements that are incremental. We're talking tenfold improvement. You'll be able to personalize your food, right, to your own person. I think this is, think about how, these are going to be huge game-changing things and this is really important to understand about any technology disruption, that we see these same patterns on how the disruption happens and how things improve and how they get better, and people still don't see it. So don't worry, don't think that today is what it is. It's going to change so much.
People told
guys,
us.
Guys, I'm gonna. Sorry, Paul. I'm gonna. Paul, I'm gonna interrupt you both. So this is my job as moderator. So I so appreciate the frank conversations here, and I believe that the audience does too. There's a couple questions coming through in the chat that I want to make sure we get a chance to address. One for you, George, is around your comment on exotic species and other animals, and in light of coronavirus, there's a conversation going on around, is there challenges with animal agriculture generally, but specifically exotic species? So if you want to comment, maybe clarify how you guys are approaching this and comments on the use of exotic species in Val's work.
That's a really, really difficult question. From the perspective of exotic species, the reason we're going down that avenue is because ultimately we think these combination products are going to be the thing which wins in the market in the long term. In the short term, selling any single exotic species into any market on the planet, it is a scary, dangerous thing to do because it's essentially a validation by a new technology industry of the quality of that existing product. There was a company, I may misquote this, so please call me out if I do get this wrong, but there was a company in the US that was working on cultured rhino horn for the Chinese medicine market to reduce the consumption of rhino horn in China. When they launched that product, or even when they announced that product, the market for rhino horn increased because it was seen as a Western validation of the medicinal value of real rhino horn. And so if we are going to go into this world of selling exotic products to try to deliberately displace these markets, we would have to be incredibly careful about how we did that in order to be responsible to the thing we're trying to achieve, which is reducing the consumption of animals out of those wet markets and not encouraging that trade by being seen as a validation of the quality of those products.
Right. Thanks, George. So the next one is from Clive Blacker. These new methods of growing and culturing food have the same levels of protein, fats, vitamins that natural products have. And there's kind of a broader question there around nutritional profiles and some of the pushback on alternative proteins against the nutritional composition.
Yeah, sure. One of the really interesting parts about all of this alternative protein, and it's true whether we're talking plant-based, cultured meat, or even some of those crazy like making protein from thin air like the guys at Solar Food, is you essentially have a recipe, as Catherine says, is this isn't a product which has to be grown in one homogenous animal that needs all of those cells together to survive. We can produce these things and bring them together in ways that otherwise couldn't. So we can effectively control all of the different nutritional properties independently from one another. If we want to make a pork which has no saturated fat, we can absolutely do that. in a way which you can't by changing animal management practices in a farm or in a feedlot.
This nutrition question is an important one, given we all want to eat food that's good for us, but it's not yet clear how this will work for alternative proteins.
I think the nutrition one is still an open debate. You know, there's really not the nutritional data yet on a lot of these products, other than a caution about the sodium levels. I think we've still got to see what the nutritional data is going to look like.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with George. I think what we'll see is just a lot of more transparency about all food and the nutrition value of makeup of all food, including animal protein, animal products. So I think that's how what we advocate for is a more open, transparent system and better labeling, be it like based on much more on environmental or nutrition. So we do advocate for that because we think that is incredibly important to this system, that it is nutritionally better or equivalent.
So what is the rise of alternative proteins, however big or small they ultimately become, and however expensive they ultimately are, actually mean for farmers?
Yeah, so there are some opportunities. So let's look at the V2 product that's come out, CSIRO and Hungry Jack's. So, you know, they're building a $20 million plant at Wodonga for that, because unfortunately the products they use in the V2 burger aren't predominantly grown in Australia. So they're importing product at the moment. So there are opportunities. And I think I said up front, there's always opportunities for alternative proteins. Where I really draw the line is Catherine's projections around that they'll take over the market. I don't think there's any data for that really at all. I think the report from AFI is a good one. It says, you know, that there's a great opportunity for more protein supply. Overall, I think they quoted it about a $19 billion growth in value. $3 billion of it they put to alternative proteins. The majority of that is to animal-based proteins. So, you know, it's a balanced report. It goes into a fair bit of detail about consumer trends, et cetera. It's a good one to look at if people want to look at a detailed report. It's focused on Australia about what the future of protein supply is going to be. So, you know, its conclusion in the end is that these are not a risk. They're just other products coming to the market, but they're not really going to challenge the traditional products, which have long histories of quality nutrition, et cetera.
Thanks, Paul. Catherine, what opportunities do you see, especially any for farmers?
I think being aware of these changes and how they might impact you are so important. I mean, obviously, I disagree with Paul a lot on the timing, but even if you think we're half right, it's going to be huge changes to the whole system, and this definitely could be a threat. So I think just keeping an eye on those price levels, the costs of the new technology, these products coming on the market, and these products that aren't plant-based, right? We're talking about the exact same products. And I think it's very different to make sure we do differentiate between those two. We personally don't see plant-based as being, we don't really take it into account in our report because we don't necessarily see it as a better version of what we're talking about. So I think just being aware of it, perhaps thinking about your feedstocks and how you could even change. I know there's lots of people in Australia, and I'm sorry for my ignorance on the Australian farming community, making a lot of wine, and how you can maybe pivot and think about what you can produce in order to support these new industries. So yeah, I think, sorry for a very incomplete answer, it's not my specialty. And
that's all right. I like the wine angle. There was people talking in the chat around other opportunities that extended shelf life, thinking more about consumers creates, and that's really aligned with how a lot of us are thinking about the agri-tech opportunity in Australia in terms of the knowledge economy and the ability to harness a lot of the innovation we've done in many agricultural sectors and take advantage of it. George,
yeah, the gene pool, sorry, just to reply a little bit, the gene pool that you guys have of all your animals and products is going to be extremely important to the knowledge base of these new products too. Mm. So like just being able to kind of capitalize on what the knowledge that you guys have, definitely.
George, thoughts on opportunities for industry?
So in Australia, I honestly believe we couldn't be better placed to take advantage of alternative protein. Paul, early on you said you think alternative protein is going to be a niche. Australian livestock products are a niche with 3% of global beef production. That is absolutely a niche product. What we have an opportunity to do here in Australia is use things like plant-based products. And as you mentioned, Paul, V2 is building a factory locally to turn agricultural commodities into finished value-added products to export. We can do a lot more of that across plant-based, across recombinant proteins, cultured meats, and other emerging bio-based food industries. Use this as a magnifier of our agricultural output. Take in huge volumes of sugar, soybeans, other legumes, value add those onshore, and end up being an exporter of 10, 20, 30% of global protein production. rather than being a niche player, but a very high-performing, high-quality and sustainable player in global livestock production alone.
And on that somewhat positive note, we'll wrap up here. There were dozens more questions in the chat and so much more that we could cover on this topic, but hopefully this gives you a taste of the live meetup and a bit to think about around alternative proteins on both sides of the fence. We tried to keep this discussion evidence-based and have some frank conversations that go beyond what you might hear at a conference. But if you haven't had enough, and of course if you have any feedback for us, please reach out or check out the blog and show notes to find more reports and resources to everything we've mentioned. Thanks again for listening, and catch you next time.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Awesome. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, George. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks so much for joining, guys. Have an amazing night, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of AgTech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.